This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
For years, Greenpeace was the only conservation group that stood up and said Indonesia needs a moratorium on deforestation to get its house in order, basically, and to make long-term land use plans. And it was unimaginable that that sort of a proposal would be supported by the political establishment in Indonesia. And then the unimaginable happened.
According to the World Bank, Indonesia is the planet's third largest carbon dioxide emitter. But the problem in Indonesia differs from ours here in the United States. Rather than pollutants from cars or the energy and industrial sectors, in Indonesia, the primary culprit is deforestation. More than 64 million acres of Indonesia's forests have been cut down or burned since 1990 in order to make room for industrial growth. Fortunately, Greenpeace has been working hard on a campaign to stop deforestation in places like Indonesia. By pressuring key corporations and governments, Greenpeace is helping to save many forests and slow climate change. One of the voices behind the Greenpeace campaign is Rolf Skar, a senior deforestation campaigner with the organization. Rolf Skar joins us today on Sea Change Radio as we discuss deforestation in Indonesia, the UN Climate Change Conference that kicks off in Cancun, Mexico next week, and how we can all make a difference with day-to-day choices as consumers. This is Alex Wise. My guest on Sea Change Radio is Rolf Skar. He is the senior forest campaigner with Greenpeace. Rolf, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Tell us a little bit about the term deforestation and what does it mean internally with Greenpeace?
Well, that's a really important question, actually, because a lot of people disagree on what deforestation is. And a lot of companies that are driving deforestation like to use very flexible definitions of what deforestation is. And they like to claim that even if let's say they're clearing an area that looks and acts like a forest and is a forest because there are a few trees that have been plucked out, they'll say that it's a degraded landscape and that it's not technically a forest. For Greenpeace globally, we have a priority campaigns in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in the Amazon basin, and then also in what we call the paradise forests of Southeast Asia. And we're in those three places in particular, sort of emphasizing them because tropical forests are such a huge part of the problem when it comes to climate change because they're responsible for more emissions than all the cars, trucks, trains, planes, and factories in the world combined, but also because they pose the biggest opportunity for both reducing those emissions and also protecting wildlife, helping local communities, and so forth.
And how does deforestation lead to the carbon problem that we're talking about?
Yeah, when people think of global warming or climate and forests, they usually think of trees and sucking in carbon. That's not the only way that, of course, forests interact with the climate. The deforestation that is leading to large amounts of pollution is often done using fire. So instead of clear-cutting an area like we're used to seeing up in northern forests, we may see virgin rainforests being slashed and burned to make way for things like cattle or for palm oil or pulp and paper plantations. So they're huge sources of greenhouse gas pollution. Also in Indonesia, some of the forests are what we call peatland areas, where there's just many feet of basically concentrated carbon that has been preserved more or less because of high water tables. And when those areas are cleared, they drain those peatlands and massive amounts of methane gas is released, and that's much more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So,
Rolf, what is Greenpeace doing to combat deforestation both in the U.S. and around the world?
We have a variety of tactics. We basically have a big toolbox. So although a lot of people know Greenpeace for its more sensational headline-grabbing actions and saving whales and things like that, we also have a pretty sophisticated team that works on research or that works on market solutions, that works on things like developing more sustainable fiber supplies for tissues like Kleenex, actually. That's a good example of some of the work we've done recently. We had a longstanding campaign against Kimberly-Clark, the maker of Kleenex tissues, and many other consumer tissues out there, because they were sourcing from endangered forests in the Canadian boreal forest, basically the big green band of forest at the top of our continent. We actually struck a deal with them last year and ended our campaign because they made remarkable commitments to protect endangered forests, to use more sustainable fiber, wood that's harvested according to a scheme called the Forest Stewardship Contract, which is basically the good housekeeping seal of approval for logging, and excuse me, and also to increase dramatically its use of recycled content fiber. So that's one example of where we do markets campaigning that affects and kind of shifts the industry players. On the other hand, we recognize that political solutions are often needed in order to build long-term solutions to deforestation. So sticking with the Canadian boreal forest, for example, this past spring, we stood side by side with some of the leading timber industry representatives in Canada and announced that we were starting a collaborative process to do long-term land use planning, set aside areas for species like woodland caribou, and also places where logging can be sustainable and can be continued into the future. So basically agreeing to sit down and come up with go and no-go zones that ultimately benefits the industry as well as the earth.
Why don't we take a step back and just tell our listeners what the problem is with palm oil and why it's become so popular and why this is something that people should be aware of.
Palm oil has gotten a lot of press recently because of its link to deforestation in Indonesia, which has set the Guinness Book of World Record for the worst deforestation rate in recent years. And the reason it's linked to that, it's not made from trees per se. It's made from the fruit of a palm tree that's planted, in many cases, where a natural forest used to be, so where virgin rainforest used to be. It's used as a frying oil and as a cooking oil in India and China. It's a very important oil to many parts of the developing world. Here in the West, we see it a lot in soaps and laundry detergents, and also a lot of packaged foods. A lot of junk foods actually have palm oil in it as well.
And then fuel as well, right?
Yeah, increasingly there's talk of using palm oil as a feedstock for biodiesel. Especially in Europe, that's been something that's speculated about quite a bit. And that speculation has driven expansion of palm oil plantations in the anticipation that brand new markets, you know, will just open up overnight. And so that's a serious concern, is that when you're trying to do something like develop a greener fuel oil, you don't want to do things like destroy the last rainforest in Indonesia. And certainly a quick analysis, you know, on the back of a napkin will show you that the greenhouse gas pollution from palm oil made on top of peatlands, for example, in Indonesia is much more polluting than regular dino oil. So, you know, you're better off with fossil fuel oils than that kind of palm oil biodiesel.
My guest is Rolf Skar. He's the senior forest campaigner with Greenpeace. What are some of the brand names and companies that people should be aware of in terms of palm oil and general deforestation, and what can they do to send a message to these companies?
Yeah, we usually start with the problem and then see who's responsible for it. And that can vary quite a bit. Usually when we're talking to people, we like to stick with brands and companies that people know. So the downstream customers who are ultimately driving the deforestation. So for example, with a problem like deforestation that's driven by palm oil, for example, there's a large conglomerate called Sinarmas, which is not a company that anyone has really heard of here in the US, but they might sell to companies like Cargill, who then sell to companies like Nestle. And so Nestle makes all kinds of products that people have heard about, and they make a very attractive campaign target for us because it's a good way to talk to people about a very real issue. And also, these are companies that can put pressure back down their supply chains. They have a choice who they buy from. And we know that choice can be used either blindly, or it can be used in a way to really push positive change. And that's what we're starting to see. Companies like Nestle, Kraft, Unilever, even Burger King, cutting out palm oil linked to deforestation in their supply chains and driving reforms. And we've seen the world's largest food and drink company, Nestle, in the last year, take a really aggressive stance towards deforestation thanks to one of our campaigns that targeted them on a global level. So they've now pledged to decouple their palm oil from deforestation over time. It's not something they can do tomorrow, but they're working on their supply chain to do that. Likewise, we'd like to see fast food and restaurants take a similar step. They've been lagging behind. Recently, Burger King announced it was going to cut contracts with one of the leading deforestation-linked companies in Indonesia, which is a good thing. But we're seeing other companies like Pizza Hut and Dunkin' Donuts and Kentucky Fried Chicken do nothing in response to proven links to deforestation. And so that's one thing folks can do is, you know, if you're at one of those establishments, or even if you're not, pick up the phone, make a call, and let them know that you want them to do something to address their deforestation problem. We've got action alerts, of course, on the Greenpeace website where people can do that with the click of a button. But, you know, there's an opportunity to do that every day.
And meat production, or beef production, has also, you talk about the fast food industry. I imagine Kentucky Fried Chicken, even if they're not using the best sustainable practices, their footprint is nothing compared to a McDonald's who's importing large amounts of beef, just from what I know about the difference of production of beef versus chicken. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the beef industry and how that leads to deforestation?
Yeah, beef is the cattle industry is a leading driver of deforestation, in particularly in the Amazon. Down there, we've seen an explosion in terms of the growth of the cattle industry giants down there. The companies there are now the biggest in the world. They're buying up U.S.-based beef companies, and that expansion of cattle grazing lands, much of it illegal, into the Amazon, has been a leading driver of deforestation there.
So what's being done about this issue?
It's being addressed, but it's still a major problem. So Greenpeace launched a report to actually outline, you know, satellite data and the facts and figures about the cattle industry and what was going on. And that was a bit of a bombshell for the industry, because soy and the expansion of soy into the Amazon had been previously the thing that had gotten all the headlines. The soy industry down there has a voluntary but pretty comprehensive soy deforestation moratorium that is renewed on an annual basis. It's not perfect, but it's clear the industry is moving, and the beef industry was happy not to have the spotlight on it. We dropped that report and started a worldwide campaign, again, following the supply chain back to brands and consumers from Italy to the U.S. And one of the things we found was that in the U.S., a lot of that Amazon beef was actually linked to leather that we were getting in shoes, Nikes, Timberlands, Reeboks, and the rest of them. And so we very aggressively targeted the footwear industry in the U.S. that very quickly got on board with our call for something to be done about the cattle deforestation problem in the Amazon.
I've been thinking about the wine we're drinking, about the line we're sinking. I'm young as a fool and green as a tree, happy as a man can naturally be. Good year coming, coming, running, good year coming soon. Good year coming, coming, running, a good year coming soon. Young as a fool and green as a tree, happy as a man can naturally be.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Rolf Scar. He's the senior forest campaigner for Greenpeace. Rolf, you mentioned Indonesia. Tell us what Indonesia is doing right now with Norway to try to solve some of their problems with deforestation.
Yeah, Indonesia is the third largest climate polluter on the planet after the U.S. and China.
Most people wouldn't guess that, I
wouldn't
imagine.
Guess that. You probably would guess Russia or India or any number of large Western countries as well.
Why is it the third?
It's because of its deforestation rate, principally. I mean, Indonesia is a large country. It's one of the most populous countries on the planet. But deforestation is right up there at the top of the reasons why they've got a huge, huge amount of pollution. For years, Greenpeace was the only conservation group that stood up and said, Indonesia needs a moratorium on deforestation to get its house in order, basically, and to make land long-term land use plans. And it was unimaginable that that sort of a proposal would be supported by the political establishment in Indonesia. And then the unimaginable happened. In May of 2010, of this year, President SBY, as he's called, and the Norwegian Prime Minister stood next to each other and announced a two-year partial moratorium on deforestation to take place starting on January 1st of 2011. Now, that was part of a bilateral deal where Norway basically put $1 billion on the table and said, if you can deliver real emissions reductions and, you know, real reductions in deforestation, we will reward you on sort of a performance-based standard over time. So that's the idea. But the first thing is, the most important thing really is reform. Because in Indonesia, there's massive confusion about what forests are, where they are, who owns them. And those are the kinds of fundamental things that need to be answered before you can really reduce emissions from deforestation. And that's what the moratorium concept is all about. Take 2 years, get your house in order, make sure there's one set of maps that everyone's working from, for example. Make sure that that the playing field is set up so that long-term decisions in sustainable development can actually happen.
What do you think are the key drivers for deforestation there?
Yeah, the drivers of deforestation in Indonesia, which have mostly been in recent years, palm oil and pulp and paper plantation expansion, those things have really taken off in the last, say, 15, 20 years. We've seen a massive influx of cash to fund all kinds of projects, and there's been a lot of speculative land grabbing as well. So a lot of this isn't, an acre for acre sort of production model. Rather, it's the Wild West out there, and a lot of companies are grabbing lands that they can simply because they can.
How are those standards created over such a short term? We're talking a two-year thing, get your house in order, get those emissions down. How do they determine whether emissions have been reduced in such a small, relatively small window when we're talking about such a large scope issue?
We can see a lot from the sky. So, for example, we can look at Landsat data, satellite data, to see how forest cover today compares to forest cover 6 months ago. We can see where deforestation is happening. So that's one way to keep track of those things. But the real the tougher job is getting down to the ground level and figuring out who owns different areas and all those sorts of things. There's a lot of work to be done, in short. The moratorium, for example, isn't even quite clear yet either. So it's not clear yet if the moratorium will cover existing concessions that have been handed out by various parts of the government over the years. That's where we see the deforestation actually happening, is places where, you know, someone has a permit, whether it's legal or not, to clear. And so we're urging the Norwegian and Indonesian government to make sure that the moratorium does cover, for example, those existing concession lands.
So a lot of the people who live in these tropical regions are a lot poorer than the larger developed G20 countries. And a lot of people would think that it might be hypocritical for these G20 countries, the richer nations, to now go to the countries that are a little more impoverished, because a lot of this fires and clearing is for subsistence farming, and these people haven't really enjoyed the fruits of the Industrial Revolution as much as some of these wealthier nations. So now that a lot of countries like China and the U.S. have grown rich over the technological innovations of the last 100 years, now these countries that are trying to get in on the action, we're pulling the plug on them, saying, oh, you know what? Carbon emissions are too high and you're cooking the planet. How does an organization like Greenpeace balance that in terms of both the human rights element along with the planetary issues?
Well, that's a key issue, especially in these UN climate talks. That's sort of the issue, is that battle between, you know, northern industrialized countries that have benefited from dirty development and countries that are rightfully trying to do something about, in some cases, immense poverty and making sure that people have the rights and the means to live healthy lives and have an access to employment. Greenpeace is very much rooted in our local campaigners. So our campaign to reduce deforestation in Indonesia is run by Indonesians who understand very well the complex social and economic landscape that we're dealing with there. No solution to deforestation can be sustainable, can work, if it doesn't address those core issues. And so we're not unrealistic about that. A lot of people are confused when we do things like campaigning in marketplaces, getting, say, Nestle to stop using palm oil linked to deforestation. They're confused thinking that we are running a campaign that's opposed to palm oil, or that we're opposed to Indonesian palm oil, or that we want boycotts to happen. And that's not at all what we're doing. We're trying to end deforestation in Indonesia and allow Indonesia to leapfrog dirty development and to make what's called in climate circles a clean development pathway that has environmental and economic benefits.
So what are some of the problems in the United States with deforestation, and how can listeners do something about it?
Yeah, the U.S. unfortunately has lost most of its primary forest, you know, the stuff that was here when white settlers showed up on the continent. But there's still a lot of beautiful landscapes and beautiful forests to fight for. Most of those are on public lands. So the private lands are mostly cut over once, twice, three, four times already. And although they may be important for watersheds and other values, the national forests and other public forests are usually where you have the highest biodiversity, where you have, you know, the environmental values that are most critical to protect. In the U.S., national forests are usually where we see the most intact forests, the forests that from an environmental perspective are the most important to protect. And so a lot of that's up in Alaska. Greenpeace has campaigns up there to reform the way that the U.S. Forest Service has been managing forests up there. And in the lower 48, there's a lot to fight for as well. Here on the West Coast, certainly you've got a band of temperate rainforest, and you've got, you know, the remnants of what was once a great forest, and those remnants are awfully important to protect. And you know, the fight for things like clean water are tied to our forests in the West. That's where most drinking watersheds come from. Ultimately, the industry in the U.S. and actually all over the world has adopted a talking point that there are more trees, you know, in the U.S. for example, than there were 50 years ago. And of course, that's a really convenient way of sidestepping the issue of deforestation, because forests are more than trees, obviously. They're complicated ecosystems. There's a whole web of life there. And so when you lose that web of life and you replace it, for example, with eucalyptus plantations in Indonesia, that's not a forest. That's not a place where indigenous people want to live. That's not a place where you'll find orangutans. That's not a place where you find Sumatran tigers. You know, because it's more like a cornfield than it is, you know, a natural forest. Industry likes to say, I'll stick with Indonesian industry in this case, that they destroy a natural forest, and because they've planted quick-growing eucalyptus or acacia that is sucking in CO2, that somehow that's carbon neutral. And of course, they've drained these massive peat forests. They've burned a natural forest that was there ahead of time. And they like to leave that part of the equation out. It takes many, many years for that carbon that has been released when you're clearing the forest to get back into trees on the ground.
While the sacred grove, where the waters flow, we will come and go in the forest. In the summer rain, where we will meet again, we will learn the code of the ancient ones in the forest.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Rolf Scar. He's the senior forest campaigner for Greenpeace. You're setting off for Cancun, Mexico in a few days for the Convention on Climate Change. I think it's 16. It's the follow-up to the Copenhagen conventions from last winter, which ended in a lot of disappointment for many people who were following it. Why don't you tell us what Greenpeace's expectations are for it and what we can hope some of the outcomes are, realistic outcomes.
Yeah, we don't expect a fab deal, which is fair, ambitious, and binding, to come out of Cancun. It didn't come out of Copenhagen. We don't think it'll come out of Cancun. Essentially, the big piece that everyone was hoping for in Copenhagen, a global deal that was binding, that was ambitious, that was going to put a lot of money on the table for cleaner development in developing countries, all those kinds of things seem seems a little out of reach. But we'd like to see more progress made on some of the basic questions, things like legal structure of whatever deal the international community comes up with, for us to answer some of those questions, for there to be more ambition on behalf of developed countries to put in place finance mechanisms and the actual finance to developing nations. And I think one of the things we may see progress on, and hopefully we'll see progress on, is this what's called RED, or a mechanism to reduce emissions from deforestation and degradation, REDD. And so that's one piece of the bigger deal that we think is a bit further along than the others, and we might make more progress on. And that's where this bilateral deal with Indonesia and Norway starts to intersect a bit with these UN talks. They're not officially part of the same process, but they're certainly informing each other. And we expect to hear more about that bilateral deal between Norway and Indonesia, as well as the moratorium at Cancun, because talks will be sort of going on side by side.
Beyond RED, at these Cancun talks, what do you expect to be covered in terms of deforestation?
Deforestation sort of split up into two rough categories in these UN talks. First is deforestation in developing countries, and then deforestation everywhere else. Industrialized nations like the US and Canada, Russia, industrialized countries with huge amounts of forests, and, you know, deforestation issues as well. There's no talks of a mechanism to, you know, reward the US, for example, for reducing its deforestation rate. However, countries like Canada seem to be using their forests as sources of very creative accounting for their own climate pollution. So, for example, when you want to measure how much a country's polluting, like Canada, you have to pick a baseline year to sort of say, you know, we're going to reduce our emissions from this amount. And Canada likes to pick a year when there were massive forest fires that dramatically increased their emissions. So in order to cut their own emissions from that level, they basically can do what they're doing right now, which is pollute more. And they'll still be under that maximum ceiling. So Russia does a lot of that sort of talk. The U.S. dabbles in it as well. And so it's amazing what people can do with numbers and how transparent some of it is. You actually don't need to be a policy wonk to understand that, you know, picking a record year for emissions tied to things like forest fires and then say you're going to cut your pollution from that record high when there are no forest fires the next year.
Great job, Canada.
Yeah, that's right. I think Russia has pledged to reduce its emissions, you know, from its pre sort of economic collapse time. So if they continue to grow and pollute and make more coal plants, they will be achieving their emissions reductions as stated at the UN. The US, of course, is no stranger to this sort of nonsense as well.
Rolf Skar, senior forest campaigner with Greenpeace, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Auntie Ballas, John Martin, and Van Morrison.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Kuva Coffee Company, Bounty Growing System, Sungevity Solar Home Specialists, and Invisible Structures, a sustainable paving company. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.